if you will. Will you welcome Dr. Michael Bellin?
Well, I want to thank you sincerely for allowing me to come here tonight. So, in response to your kindness, I would like to do you a favor. I'd like to help you learn the easy way, things that I learned the hard way, with a lot of pain, a lot of distress, and a lot of doubt. I'm going to tell you the story of a silly man and a slow learner. I'm that man. I'm that slow learner. And I'll try to tell you what it took me years to figure out so that maybe you can save some time and do a better job of it than I did. I want to tell you how come I no longer believe today what I used to believe in the 60s. This is the chronicle of my undeception. So I'm going to begin with a confession. I confess to believing at one time or another nearly all the pervasive and persistent fantasies of the 1960s. In Joni Mitchell's words, I thought that all I had to do was get back to the land to set my soul free. I thought that flowers had power. I thought that love could be free. And I thought the system was to blame. By 1968, I had the whole world figured out. I knew the cause of every evil, America, and I knew the solution to every problem, freedom and tolerance. Now, of course, if the truth be told, I knew nothing, at least nothing worth knowing. I knew how to posture, but not how to stand. I knew how to protest, but not how to protect. I knew how to work up an impressive case of moral outrage, but didn't know morality. I knew about peace, didn't know enough to fight for it. I knew about self-indulgence, self-preservation, self-esteem, and self-expression. I didn't know about self-sacrifice and self-control. And worse still, I didn't even know myself. I didn't know, for example, what Socrates knew about me, that just like everybody else, I came into the world in a state of complete, total, and seamless ignorance, that I could never cure my ignorance as long as I remained so blissfully unaware of it. I didn't know what St. Augustine knew about me, that the well of my soul was poisoned, and that whatever was down in the well would come up in the bucket. St. Augustine also knew this about my soul. No matter how hard it tried, no matter where it looked, it could never find its rest anywhere but in God. I didn't know what Edmund Burke knew about me, that no government could fix what was wrong with me, either by the things that it did or the things that it didn't do. The most any government could do was to help protect me from myself and from others. Most importantly, I didn't know that I was every man. We're all in the same boat. When I learned that we're all in the same boat and that boat is sinking, I stopped being a liberal. Because like almost all the dissidents in my generation, I was a protester without a plan and a visionary without a vision. I hadn't learned that you see only what you're able to see. And I was able to see only the egalitarian, relativistic, self-gratifying superstitions of the secular wayward left. You shouldn't think that this was just a case of untutored innocence. It wasn't. It was ignorance and it was evil, but I would have denied it at that time. Only very slowly and rather stupidly did I come to understand that my fellow dissidents and I had taken for ourselves the easiest and the least productive of all tasks, that of denigrator. And only slowly did I come to understand that to destroy is easy. To build is hard, and to preserve is actually the hardest of all. But it was worse than that because my fellow dissidents and I were blind to some of the most obvious truths, especially to what Russell Kirk once called the tragic vision of life. The tragic vision of life is the humbling realization that evil's not something out there, evil's something in here. The tragic vision of life arises from the fact that we human beings are flawed. We are deeply, desperately, tragically flawed, and we can't be trusted. We're all broken at the heart, and our defects are life-wide and soul-deep. And even though we're capable of reason, because of all our selfish passions and our moral weaknesses, we are rarely ever reasonable. We ourselves are what's wrong with the world. We ourselves are this planet's most malignant and enduring ailment. It's us. We have our dignity, that's for sure. But look carefully, you'll notice we have our horror too. We're scary. I can tell you this, I didn't wake up until I met the enemy face to face. I met him in the mirror. Everybody does. I had to learn to stare squarely into that face in the mirror, into the face of hard fallen reality, and not to flinch. I did not, in fact, I could not, comprehend the tragic vision of life until I learned that the problem of the human heart is at the heart of the human problem. And once I examined with care and honesty the habits of my own heart and the habits of my dissident friends' hearts, I learned finally that C.S. Lewis was right. To be one of the sons of Adam or the daughters of Eve is both glory enough to raise the head of the lowest beggar and shame enough to lower the head of the highest king. I'm a human being. That's my wealth, and that's my poverty. Now, before my undeception, I was like every other cultural and political liberal. I'd fallen prey to what Gene Kirkpatrick used to call the error of misplaced malleability. Malleability just means you can shape it like clay. I thought that human institutions could be reshaped at will to fit the plans existing inside my head. It cannot be done. It cannot be done. Here's why it can't be done. Human institutions arise from human action. Human action arises from human nature. And human nature is notoriously broken and unfixable. Only the grace of God can fix it. I finally learned, slowly, that my deepest need was not more freedom. I needed the grace and guidance of God. Until I understood that, I remained shamelessly superficial. I had to learn to put my airy and insipid romanticism where it belonged. And it belonged on the growing junk pile of fatally flawed and conclusively overthrown fantasies to which the human mind seems always to be giving rise. It's not romanticism, but religion. Not Byron, but the Bible. Not poetry, but Paul. Not Voltaire, but virtue. Not trends, but tradition. Not idealism, but ideas. Not genius, but grace that could save me and cure me. I had to exchange Wordsworth for the Word and revolution for repentance. And while some of the things I valued then were useful and good, none of them were properly fundamental. I had not yet learned to put first things first. And so the tragic vision of life humbled me. From the tragic vision of life, I learned that it wasn't my prerogative to invent wisdom and virtue. Wisdom and virtue had already been invented. My responsibility was to listen to the God who invented them. My responsibility was to listen to those whom God had taught. Wisdom and virtue were not born with my generation. I had to learn in the last half of the 20th century what was already old news, even back in the days of Jeremiah, the ancient prophet. Jeremiah said, "Stand at the crossroads and look and ask for the ancient paths where the good way lies, and walk in it and find rest for your souls." Hear it again. Stand at the crossroads and look and ask for the ancient paths where the good way lies and walk in it and find rest for your souls. Wisdom is found by walking the ancient paths, and those ancient paths led through the wilderness, you'll remember, and through the sea, even through the valley of the shadow of death, and not like I thought, not through Berkeley, not Columbia, not the Village, not Watts, not Haight-Ashbury, not Altamont, and not Woodstock. The tragic vision of life taught me that order is the most fundamental of all political and social needs. And because order is so important, I learned that the police are not pigs. I learned that the police are not an occupying army intent upon destroying my freedom. It was just the opposite. Imperfect as the police sometimes are, they are the paid guardians of freedom and the protectors of life and property. In the line of duty, some of them have even died for me and for you. The tragic vision of life taught me that you cannot reject authority. You cannot reject authority, whether it's civil authority, family authority, cultural authority, or divine authority. You can't reject authority and still live in an orderly world. Because when you off the pigs of whatever sort, you give birth to an outlaw culture, not to the wisdom of the ages. Enforceable law and law enforcement are requirements of the first rank. Because human nature is what it is, without great volumes of enforceable law, freedom is impossible to maintain. As Dean Clarence Mannion once said, in fact, this is the last sentence he wrote in his very life, he said in 1979 that the society that's not held together by its teaching of an observance of God's laws is unfit for human habitation and doomed to destroy itself. Well, Dean Mannion was right. So ask yourself, even though freedom is so important, ask yourself, when is freedom not enough? Freedom is not enough every time that truth and righteousness are at stake. And in a fallen world like ours, that's almost always. Freedom must be exercised according to the dictates of truth and virtue. You must never try to shape virtue and truth to fit your freedom. Freedom must be limited by the demands of justice and love and revelation. The most important consideration regarding any human activity is not, is it free, but is it good? Whenever somebody insists upon freedom, I always have to ask them, freedom to do what? You have to ask that question because freedom is an incomplete concept. It just can't be for freedom. What freedom are you for? What will you do with it? Freedom, in some occasions, is like tyranny in that it sometimes has unintended and unforeseen consequences, and some of them are colossally vile. I'll just mention one here, the alleged freedom to abort. From the tragic vision of life, I learned that you have to do what's right whether it suits you or not, and whether you like it or not. Well, some of you recall that in the 60s we didn't do much that didn't suit us. I also learned that the enemy is not the CIA, not the FBI, and not the GOP. It's the NEA, NOW, NBC, ABC, CBS, CNN, DNC, WCC, and NPR. It's the entire grab bag of alphabetized leftist subverters of culture, truth, and wisdom. I learned that those who deprive themselves of the wisdom of Western tradition are no more free than a baby abandoned by its parents to do whatever it wishes. That baby's going to die. I learned that politics is not about equality. Politics is not about equality. It's about justice. Equality is getting what your neighbor gets. Justice is getting what you deserve. They are frequently very different things. I learned that personal action isn't about freedom. It's about righteousness. I learned that sex isn't about pleasure. It's about love and privilege and posterity. Those things and more I learned from the tragic vision of life, and I would commend those things to you. They taught me that in many ways the 60s were twisted and misshapen. Well, the 60s are over, and that's a good thing. The 60s were a bad idea, if for no other reason than that the 60s had not many ideas. They just had a lot of selfish desires hiding behind the shallow slogans on psychedelic bumper stickers. Slogans like, I protest, therefore I am. The only things about which we were intellectually humble in the 60s were the claims of objective truth. That didn't impress us at all. We seemed unable to wrap our minds around even the most obvious ideas. We seemed unable to realize, for example, that you cannot raise your consciousness until you have one. The 60s were maybe the most unconscious decade in centuries. It was a time of suffocating intellectual mediocrity, and from that mediocrity, our nation has not yet fully recovered. So, I can imagine a high school or college age student hearing what I'm saying and wondering, well, okay, Bauman, this might all be well and good, but what's that got to do with me? I wasn't even alive in the 60s. Well, here's the answer. While the 60s are over, they're not dead, not by a long shot. The 60s live. In fact, the 60s thrive. Not just in the White House juvenocracy, which is tragic enough, but in the faculty lounges and endowed chairs of nearly every college and university in the United States. Tenured faculty members everywhere have traded their old tie-dyed t-shirts and blue jeans for a cap and a gown. Those tenured faculty members are the entrenched purveyors of an unexamined and indefensible hand-me-down Marxism, and what Alan Bloom once called nihilism with a happy ending. It's doomed that we're all smiling. These professors have become the paid agents of the very universities and colleges they once tried to burn to the ground. And not because they gave up on the dreams of the 60s, they didn't. What they failed to do as protesters, they now do as professors. You know the names. I don't have to tell you the names. Quite possibly they've done it to you. I don't know. Because it seems to me the entire teaching profession, from pre-kindergarten to graduate school, has become the political captive of the cultural left. Like roving street gangs that prowl the halls of the academy, power-hungry bands of leftist professors have instituted numberless turf wars, most of which they won. They won. Here's what they won. They have succeeded in overthrowing academic freedom in the name of tolerance. They have succeeded in stifling debate in the name of openness. They have succeeded in exalting egalitarianism above all other ideas in the name of equality. They have succeeded in segregating and tribalizing the university and the nation and the culture by gender, by age, by religion, by race, and by sexual preference, all in the name of unity. The schools and colleges that hire and then tenure those folks commit academic treason as far as I can see. I simply remind you that any intellectual community, like a college or university, that's unwilling or unable to identify its enemies cannot possibly defend itself. Those who now cherish free institutions and those who now cherish the wisdom and the virtue that sustains free institutions now have to stand up boldly against the barbarians already inside the gates, guarding the gates. Now, because the 60s live, our decade, this decade, has become irrational, ignorant, and morally illiterate. I mean, if the 60s were so majestically self-indulgent, this decade, our decade, is perhaps the most self-congratulatory decade our nation's ever seen. Not because we succeeded where everybody else failed, but we're patting ourselves on the back all day long, even though we failed, where they almost always succeeded. We have failed in learning to learn, in learning to work, in learning to listen, and in learning to worship. This decade is a decade determined to ignore and to belittle and to malign things like beauty, truth, and goodness. Three things that most modern and postmodern people think are in the eye of the beholder. This decade is the sworn enemy of revelation and of righteousness. Just try bringing those two things up in a conversation in a public place. If the threefold mantra of the 60s back then was tune in, turn on, and drop out, well, then the mantra of today is comprised of the four silly sentences that have descended from those notions. And these are the four silly sentences. Everything is relative. There is no right or wrong. There are no absolutes, and who's to say? If you can't figure out why belief in those four sentences is the death of learning and the death of virtue, well, then maybe for that very reason you'll understand why I have to spend nearly all my time as a professor and as a writer defending the ancient liturgy of the enlightened mind. That right and wrong are matters of fact, not matters of feeling. That without God there is no good. That justice is not equality. That new isn't the same as better. And that relativism, secularism, and pragmatism are not the friends of beauty, truth, and goodness. Most modern folks probably don't realize and probably don't care that they themselves are the befuddled and bedeviled lackeys of designer truth or of made-to-order reality or of ad hoc morals making, but that's what they are. If you follow those folks, you walk into the night without a light and into the woods without a compass. I want to tell you as plainly as I can tell you that their vision of academic freedom lacks intellectual virtue. Their version of academic freedom dilutes the high cultural inheritance of the past with the petty and insupportable leftisms of the present. Well, a minute ago, you remember I was talking about what a student might be wondering about my comments. I can also imagine someone thinking that all I've done since the 60s is just change sides in the culture war that goes on around us. But if you think all I did was just change sides, that I moved from there to here, and that's just a move, not an improvement, if you think that, well then, somehow you must be assuming that flower power and Christianity are morally equivalent. Or that hippies rank with saints. Two false assumptions which, if you make them, show just how much a child of the 60s you really are. I've often wondered, why in the world does this decade feel so much like the 60s? It feels like a 60s renaissance. It's all been born again. The 60s have come back. Well, I discovered the answer to that question in a college cafeteria and in conversations with some of my students' parents. First, the parents. I have noticed that my students say and think many of the same sorts of things that their parents say and think when I speak with the parents. That happens because the acorn doesn't usually fall very far from the oak tree. And that fact is more than a little significant because lots and lots of the parents of today's college and graduate school students were probably children of the 60s. And many of the responses that my students learned to give to life are responses they learned from their parents. And more often than not, those responses are the stock responses of the 60s. Now, one way, of course, that's good in the sense that I want my students to learn all the truth they can from their parents. But I did say truth. Insofar as my students' responses mimic the responses of the 60s, well, then my students have to learn the same lessons I had to learn. My students have to come to understand with all the clarity and courage they can muster the truth about the tragic vision of life. That we are, every one of us, morally defective, ethically twisted, and spiritually dead. If my students fail to come to that realization and to act appropriately upon it, they and their world will suffer. Now the cafeteria. I often notice that my students echo some of the things they hear their teachers say. When I'm talking to students in the cafeteria, sometimes I get the eerie feeling I'm not in the cafeteria at all, I'm in a faculty meeting. Because I frequently hear the voice and the unmistakable intonations of my colleagues just coming from other people. Now, I want my college students to learn all the truth they can from their professors, but then again, like I said, we're talking about truth. And that's the rub. Because like me, lots of their teachers were children of the 60s. Children of the 60s who have since then made only an incomplete break with the errors of that particular era. I want my students to know that their ideas have family resemblances. I notice, for example, when the parents come to campus, my students look a lot like their parents. Not surprising. Well, my students' ideas look a lot like their parents' ideas, too. And when I hear them say certain things, I want to ask my students, from where do you suppose that your rampant relativism and your not very carefully hidden contempt for authority actually arise? And whenever I think about asking that question, I already know the answer. It comes from the 60s and from people like me that allegedly reached their emotional and intellectual maturity at that time. So, what do you do? Well, here's my point. If you believe in the 60s, or if you believe in today, you believe a lie. Like I did, you need an undeception. In order to get that undeception, you need to go back way beyond the 60s. You have to go back to the wisdom that's older even than time. You have to go back to God and to the wisdom that spoke the universe into existence. That's how far back you have to go. You need to go back to the God who made you and redeemed you, because real answers are found nowhere else. Now, it shouldn't surprise you when I tell you to do that, that if you actually do it, you're going to meet energetic and determined opposition. Sometimes even from those who are on your side, who call themselves Christians and conservatives. As Socrates himself observed many centuries ago, most folks do not take kindly to preachers of moral reform, to pursuers of the good. There's no telling, he said, what might happen to such a person? Well, don't let that stop you. You should do it anyway. You do it because you need it, and you do it because it's right, even though it's difficult. It's always easy to be a modernist. It's always easy to go with the spirit of the age. It's always easy to float downstream. But in the face of the world's downward slide, you have to be vigilant, and you have to be strong, and you have to be perceptive, and you have to be courageous. The world needs people like that. It needs people that are unafraid to turn around and walk back into the light. Our world needs people like that more than maybe it ever has, because everywhere you look, the adversary culture of the 60s has become the dominant culture of today. Our cultural heritage is being embezzled from under our very noses. If you think of yourself as a Christian, or if you think of yourself as a conservative, or as both, well, then admit it. The view from here is haunting, isn't it? We don't own the White House. We don't own the Congress. We don't own the courts. We don't own the media. We don't own the arts. We don't own the sciences. We don't own the marketplace. We don't own the academy. We don't own anything. Look, we don't even own the churches. It's owned by the 60s. And therefore, if, as I did, you find yourself an unwilling child of the 60s, well, then I would invite you, I would exhort you, to turn with an open mind and an open heart to the prophets and the apostles in Scripture and to the great poets and sages outside of Scripture. Their truth is your only liberation from postmodernist slavery. It's your only liberation from slavery to your own desires. Just because you're doing what you want doesn't mean you're free. You can be a slave to your own desires, and don't forget it. The 60s still hates what America, spelled with a K, and it still hates what made America possible. It still hates faith in God. It still hates the sacredness of the family. It still hates the sanctity of life, individual responsibility, local limited government, and traditional morality. The leftists of today are the enemies of heartland values. They want you to keep quiet. They desperately want you to keep quiet. Don't give them what they want. They want you to sit meekly in the corner of the room with your hands folded and mouth shut. They want you to be nice. They want the friends of beauty, truth, and goodness to speak only those things that offend no one. That they offend you does not matter. They want you to stick to the script. They want you to keep your views to yourself and to act as if your views were not true. In fact, they want you to act as if there were no truth. That's what political correctness or political cleansing is all about. So just think about it for a moment. What kind of man or woman would you be if you let yourself be controlled by the empty criticisms of the rootless left? What kind of world would you be creating for those who came after if you neglected to restore reality to human thinking? If you turned your back on the only thing that can make you content, even in dungeons, even in slums, and even in the face of death? My desire for you is that you throw off the vestiges of leftist cultural subversion, that you make yourself a devotee and guardian of the wisdom of the ages, that you become the sworn enemy of nonsense in all its forms, and most importantly, that you become the faithful and ardent friend of God, because then and only then can you be free. What's been given to you as a heritage, you now have to accept as a quest. If you want to be wise, you have to learn from your ancestors. You have to learn to make peace with the wisdom of the ages and with those who gave it, regardless of their sex or their race or their ethnic background. You have to do so because wisdom and truth are not gender-based or race-based or nation-based. They are revelation-based and thought-based. And you probably understand by now that reading the Bible carefully and thinking well are very hard work. Knowledge isn't parochial. Knowledge isn't the private property of any one race, any gender, any era, or any ethnic group. Knowledge belongs to those who are determined to get it, those who seek it passionately, those who will not be denied, no matter how difficult the circumstances are that are arrayed against them. They are going to get the knowledge. And so in that light, I would invite you tonight to make one of the most important choices of your whole life? Ask yourself, which will you have? Truth or rest? Truth or relaxation? Truth or repose? You cannot possibly have both. Now, those four sentences that I mentioned to you, everything's relative, there is no right or wrong, there are no absolutes, and who's to say? If you had the great misfortune of being in one of my classes at Hillsdale, I'd put that on the syllabus on the first day and tell you these are the four forbidden sentences. You are not permitted to say any of these four things. And I'll ask the students, now why would you suppose I'd ban those four sentences? You know, and you always get some smart out saying, because you don't like free speech. And I say, no, I like free speech. I just don't like stupidity. And this is stupid. Can you see how these things are stupid? And they start to think about it. Everything's relative. Everything is relative. Everything is relative. And then they realize the sentence, everything is relative, is part of everything. And if the sentence, everything is relative, then something's absolute. If something's absolute, everything isn't relative. If this sentence is right, this sentence is wrong. It's what they call autophagic. It eats itself up. An interesting visual. There is no right or wrong. You probably heard people say that to you. There's no right or wrong. Well, you should say to them, is that right? What are they going to say? Yes, it is, or no, it isn't. Because they can't say either one. Their stupid sentence just took that option away. When someone says to you there is no right or wrong, they think they're right to say it and you're wrong to deny it. But of course you couldn't be. Or there are no absolutes. That's an absolute. There are absolutely no absolutes is what that means. Oh, you mean except for this one. How come you get to cheat? How come you get to break the rule that you're making? Or who's to say? Who's to say is the interrogative form of what they used to call the old ad hominem argument. An ad hominem argument is an argument against the arguer, not the argument. So, you know, maybe I'll say something like, you know, abortion is evil, and they say, well, yeah, you're a moron. Well, maybe I'm a moron, but that's really not the point. You know, thanks for thinking about me. But the point is the point. In this case, the point is the morality of abortion. And when they say who's to say, they're trying to take away your right to talk. See, they're not trying to have a debate. They're trying to end a debate. They're trying to shut you up like they tried to shut her up. And when someone says to you, who's to say? You say back to them, who's to ask? How come you get to talk and I don't? Or when someone says to you, who's to say, you say, whoever has the best arguments is to say, let's have the debate and find out who that is. But when they say those things, they're not trying to have a debate, they're trying to stop the debate. If you're watching Oprah, say, and maybe they're talking about cloning or something, and the guest will say, well, you know, Oprah, this is a tough issue, this cloning thing, and in the end, you have to admit it, you know, that everything's relative. There is no right or wrong. There are no absolutes. And who's to say it? The audience goes, yeah, that was good. No, it wasn't. That was four stupid things in machine gun fashion. Boom, 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 boom. And you can't let that get by. You have to be the sworn enemy of nonsense in all its forms. And that's four of its forms. So don't let them shut you up with nonsense. Expose the nonsense for what it is. But you can't, if you're going to teach them, you have to remember this. A teacher can't give what a teacher doesn't have. You're going to have to figure this out for yourself first. You have to put your own ideas and your own thoughts under scrutiny, relentless scrutiny. Otherwise, if you don't find your own weaknesses in the conversations inside your own head, your enemies will find them for you in a public debate. So, save yourself the embarrassment and attack your own thoughts first and find out their weaknesses and then shore them up with reason and revelation.
I get the next question. Yeah. You kind of get in the drift of why I said something about sound bites in the introduction there. Okay, this is not a sound bite guy. Dr. Bauman, would you make a comment to us about, you know, you and I had a conversation this afternoon about philosophy. I also didn't ever take, never had any logic. I have a friend that I respect a lot that said, that talks about how we don't teach logic anymore. Would you make a comment about that?
Yeah, we don't spend much time in logic, either in learning it or in practicing it. And that is painfully obvious. You probably heard on radio shows people call in, and they might have the same view you do, and you're grateful for that, but then they start developing it and defending it in the most bizarre ways, and you just wish that they would get off the phone. It won't hurt you to buy an introduction to a logic book and work your way page by page through it. It's not the most exciting reading. I'm just telling you, the plot will be weak. But it's good for your brain. And, you know, give your brain some exercise. If you don't use it, you lose it. So go ahead and do some logic exercises. That way, when you'll know how to avoid making the mistakes yourself. And when your opponents make the mistakes, you'll know how to identify them and expose them. It's a great tool. You can't let them set the agenda either verbally or intellectually. The great buzzword now is equality. Like, for example, in the same-sex marriage debate. All people are equal. Well, okay, let's say that's true. Everybody's equal. But here's a logical fallacy. They think that because all people are equal, all lifestyles are equal. That doesn't follow logically. And so it's not about equality. It's about something else. Just because all people are equal doesn't mean all lifestyles are equal. That's an illogical leap. Also, point this out to them. Point out a certain practical and real-world impossibility. It is impossible to maximize both freedom and equality. Because human beings are, I would call this like the snowflake principle of human beings. No two are alike. They're always different in some ways, in fact, occasionally in some remarkable ways. And since no two of them are exactly alike, if you're going to force them to be equal in any meaningful way, you have to suppress their freedom. If you let them be free, they will be unequal. If you want to make them equal, you have to prevent them from being free. Let people know that if they're going for equality, the price for the equality is freedom. And lots of people will not willingly give up their freedom. Let them know that's where their argument goes. And among those people who lose freedom will be the people who for equality themselves.